Up to this point, Haman, who had been not quite, but almost all-powerful, he had just been humiliated, at least by his own estimation. Remember, in chapter 6, he had been startled into having to lead the parade from Mordecai, who had so far been, if not his archenemy, at least the bane of his life. This was the same Haman who in chapter 3 is described as the enemy of the Jews. Here he was the officer of the king, leading the praise of this man who was his arch enemy, that bane of his life. Haman's wife saw that as the beginning of the end, in chapter 6, verse 13, that if this is how it is turning out so far, you are going to fall before him, before Mordecai. That's how she understood the omens, you might say. But it had not yet changed the position of the Jews. They were still under threat of annihilation. However much Zeresh, Haman's wife, perceived of their peculiar strengths, as would be suggested in chapter 6. There were some steps that had been taking place in chapter 5, but they were interrupted by the events of chapter 6, just overnight, really, through to just between banquets. The telling of these events was interrupted. But at the end of chapter 6, we are taken back there as the king's eunuchs came, hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. In this story, we have been meeting several people. These are not just events. It's not just a story, a sequence of events, but these are people, various characters who are working out this story. They are acting. It's these people that I think come especially to the fore in chapter 7. One writer puts it this way. He says of Israel, a nation that it is a nation that had a providential function, and reminds us that the Bible is not a history, we might insert, not first a history of Israel, but it is a history of redemption, of a long divine act. If that is the case, then these people in this story, the story of the Jews, these people, in their personalities, in their actions, as they acted apparently according to their own wisdom or otherwise, they were working out God's work. This Bible is the story of a long divine act. It's not just the story of Esther, or the story of Ahasuerus, or of Haman, or in other chapters of Mordecai. It's God's story. We don't see it in the book itself. We're not told that. But within the context, as I said last week, of the Bible, these people, when they did what they did, they were accomplishing God's work. Each of them in very different ways. But this is what even this chapter speaks about. So I want to look at these people, look at them as people in a way, and what they demonstrate in the setting of this chapter. We have the story. I think the story is something that even as we read there, you can get to grips with. It's very well told, very well shaped, and you can see what is taking place and the ups and the downs of the various characters involved here. But I think perhaps by highlighting something of the different approach of the three main characters in this chapter, it might also highlight something of how God is going about his work during this phase of the people, of the story of the people of Israel. I want to focus then first on, I'm calling her the deliberate advocate, Esther. Then we also see the volatile despot Ahasuerus, and finish with the cowardly bully Haman. And really, that's following something of the progression of the story. It is Esther who is prominent to begin with, then Ahasuerus, and in the third place, Haman, although it is very brief. First then, to look at Esther. I'm calling her the deliberate advocate, because that is what the approach that she takes in this particular chapter. I've previously endeavored to point out, again very briefly, ways that Esther has reflected biblical wisdom, which is godly wisdom, therefore. I've referred to a number of the Proverbs on occasion, which apply to the way that she has behaved in the glimpses we've had of her in other parts of the book. We saw how she obtained favor with the people around her on account of her discretion, which becomes apparent as time goes on. We saw too how she took time, she paused, she didn't jump to conclusions, but she paused for a while before she stepped into danger approaching the king. There was something of character about her which seems to have appealed to the king himself that has brought her to the fore into this place that we find her this evening. But it's perhaps here most clearly that her skills, perhaps developed over the past 9 years, her skills, her finer spirit, these things are evident, and they seem to harmonize with that biblical sensitivity that Proverbs speaks about. The scene is familiar to us, I think, from in the story yesterday. It was just the day before that the king and Haman had been at an earlier wine banquet provided by Esther. And they reappear, they come again. That's a similar setting. And again, as he did on the first occasion, the king asked the question, "What is your petition?" He allowed her on that first occasion to say, "Please come again." No further progress. But he's persistent. He knows, as we saw back in chapter 5, he knows she would not have risked her life as she had done coming to him if there wasn't something substantial on her mind, not just an invitation to a banquet. She approaches, she responds. He asks her, "What is your petition? What is your request?" "It will be granted. It will be done." In verse 2. And Esther answers. There are no histrionics, although they could be forgiven. We know the story. We know that her life was forfeit along with her people. But she takes great care. Great care, not just to be calm, but to be shrewd and clever and wise in the things that she has to say and how she says them. She observes the appropriate forms. She acknowledges that she is dependent upon the favor of the king and the pleasure of the king to begin with. This is the right form. She's building her petition deliberately. It comes across with a very calm approach, at least initially, even as we read. But it somewhat belies, doesn't it, the extent of her plea. This is such a transformation as she goes through that appropriate form, "If I found favor." And then what does she say? "Let my life be given me." Surely in the setting, this is, we know the background to it, but in the setting, if we remember how the story was unfolding, this was quite a startling request. "Let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request." One commentator remarks that where in verse 2 the king says twice, "What is your petition? What is your request?" she takes advantage of that. It's really just a rhetorical device. He is just reinforcing. He's saying, "I'm liberal in my generosity." But she takes advantage of that. She says, "My petition and my request, my life and the life of my people." We see here too that she is committing her own life to her, to this people. There is more to be revealed, I think, that's not spoken of in this chapter, but she is attaching herself, she's identifying herself with this people that was in danger of being eliminated. But remember, on all along the way, Haman is in this same room. He's listening. Could he go through, do a mental check, how many peoples in this whole empire are under danger of being eliminated? Was he starting to wake up to the connections that had not yet been revealed? Esther's people. But then she explains where this is coming from. In verse 4, "We've been sold, my people and I." That does reflect the unsavory character of the scheme. Remember how Haman settled the matter. He didn't just ask to be permitted to or to encourage the king to send out a decree to wipe out a certain people that was a problem in the empire. But he also said, "Well, I'll put some money in," and big money it was as well. And that seems to have established the scheme. And Esther is perhaps, it would seem, making slight reference to that, but in a very shrewd way. She's not making accusation to the king, although really he is responsible. But it does indicate the unsavory nature of what has taken place thus far. And then she says, what I've been sold for is, and she uses the threefold wording that was there in the announcement that was sent out through the 127 provinces. Haman's edict in chapter 3 uses exactly these words to destroy. The purpose is to destroy, verse 13 of chapter 3, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. That's what's going to happen to me and my people, Esther is reminding the king. It certainly serves to explain the risks that she has taken to get to this point. It's an extreme position. And she reinforces how extreme it is by adding an argument to deflect any possible irritation or anger that her king might direct at her for bothering him. She says, "If it were anything less than this, I would not have bothered you." In the first part of verse 4, she's saying, this is what's happened. I've been sold. The time is coming when I and my people will be destroyed, killed, annihilated. If we had been sold as male and female slaves, a dreadful fate, I would have held my tongue. I would not have said anything, even for something as bad as that. I'm just pleading because we're going to be eliminated. So she adds a very shrewd argument. There's a lot of discussion as to what exactly the end of that verse is indicating, but basically it's saying that I would never trouble you. She said that, I would have held my tongue. I would not have troubled you. I would have held my tongue as, put it perhaps better this way, as some of the words like enemy, for example, can have a range of meaning in the original language, and on balance it probably is more understandable if we see it as I would have held my tongue as that calamity to be sold as, if I and my people had been sold as male and female slaves, that calamity would not have compared with the trouble that I would have caused the king in her petition, in what she has just been doing. That she didn't want the king to feel that this was just a storm in a teacup, that it was a lot of trouble over nothing. She's saying, to me this is worth coming all the way. It's only the most extreme danger. I plead with you to understand it as that. That's drawn, led me to bring this to your attention. Now, I would ask you to remember what's been going on until this point, and then the way that Esther approaches this carefully, deliberately as she presents the case before the king. I've often referred to Proverbs, and it's appropriate in this case as well. She's taken her time. Remember, she took those 3 days to fast before she went to the king. And Proverbs 25:15 says, "By long forbearance a ruler is persuaded, and a gentle tongue breaks a bone." In her gentleness, she is effective, as we come to see in just a moment. And she has taken her time. She has paused, and as the king will come to see in due course, this is something that has been in place for a time, and she has not just rushed into crying out for help. She has prepared the way and demonstrated, as I've said before, this biblical wisdom. And then she says no more. She presents that and leaves it with the king. Although there is the suggestion in verse 5 where the king answered and said, those two words, answered and said, that it's basically the same wording. The king said and said, it's perhaps an indication of his urgency and his interruption of the queen. But a very appropriate question that he has for her. And the only further thing that she has to say is to name her adversary when the king asks her. A deliberate advocate. She's not just speaking for herself, but for her people, and she goes about it in a very deliberate way, arguing her position. In some contrast, you come to the volatile despot, Ahasuerus. Despot, a man who has absolute power and uses it purely as he chooses. You can have a benevolent despot, you can have one who's quite tyrannical. Here we have certainly a volatile man, Ahasuerus. Up to this point, Esther, as she presents what she has to say, may well have still been quite unsure of the king's mind, and she would only have had to look back at the past 9 years of her experience of the king to know that he could be up and down in a flash. What was his response going to be? But I think verse 5 indicates what it was, and it was favourable to her. He fires away a very quick investigation. Who is he? Where is he? This person who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing. That in itself is an indication, isn't it, that her plea had been effective. He was intolerant of any such thing. There's no indication here yet that he has any recall of the decree. In fact, the decree was signed, wasn't it, with his signet ring, but signed by Haman, sent out under his name. Did he have any idea of it himself? It doesn't seem so. Who would dare presume? And Esther then drives home her advantage. Three words: adversary, enemy, wicked, wicked Haman, in verse 6. Haman's terror, Haman's response in that setting also indicates what the king's response was. Haman was a man who had been right beside the king. He knew his king. He knew that man. And it tells us that Haman, verse 6, was terrified before the king and queen. He'd seen enough. He'd heard enough to know that he was in huge danger himself. If you think back in the story, the Jew's fate had been decided by a dismissive remark by the king. He wasn't too bothered. If Haman wanted to process things in that way, that's fine. But now he was faced with, you might even put it this way, the theft of his lovely queen. And if she had a people that went with her, then include them too. Here was a man who he had relied on, wisely or not. He finds that he's been threatening this queen, his wife. And there's perhaps a beginning understanding of deception that has been played on him. And we see very plainly stated in verse 7 that the king was furious. He rose in his wrath from the banquet of wine into the palace garden. And for a man in that position to be furious, it was a very dangerous place to be around. A man who was absolutely powerful, except it would seem over his own mind and spirit. Ahasuerus storms out into the palace garden. There's an abruptness about the expression. Our versions include "and went" in verse 7, but it's "he rose from the banquet into the palace garden." Stormed out. Proverbs 20 says, "The wrath of a king is like the roaring of a lion. Whoever provokes him to anger sins against his own life." There's perhaps an element, and it is perhaps advisable too. Maybe Ahasuerus had learnt that much, that when you're angry, it's best to step away. And it's something of that perhaps is behind this. We don't know for sure. The story is told us so quickly. But we do know that on every other occasion, and even in this part of the story, in verse 9, that whenever the king needed to decide something, he was entirely dependent on his advisors, and he would go with what pleased him out of their advice. And perhaps he didn't know what was the next step. He certainly needed to take a bit of time to get through it. But in many ways, this was an ill-disciplined man. He didn't need to be disciplined. He had that power. But his ill-discipline had allowed this situation to arise. It's because he didn't care. He didn't care to investigate any further that God's covenant people were under threat of extinction. And this is the man that we're facing, that Haman is facing, on that day at that banquet. But it is the world that we live in. There are many who are in similar positions, who approach things in a similar way. I've just been reading a very detailed account of the last days of Rhodesia, and the Ian Smith, who was the Prime Minister, and his great disillusionment with British authorities for their changeable approach. They would say one thing in his face, they'd come home and they'd do something completely different, and year after year after year. It's maybe just one example, and maybe not the worst of examples, but how many people within such positions have that same measure of ill discipline? We read it this morning in 1 Peter chapter 2, that yet these are the people who are in positions of authority. These are the positions given to them by God. And that's something that we come back to. I said at the beginning, it is part of the story of God's work, not just of such men as this, but he has used such men as this to do his work. Ways he chooses to work in these ways that we wonder at the wisdom at times, but it's his work to use such a man in all his waywardness, in his erratic behavior. And what we do find, although he was very callous at one point, dismissing this rebel people without inquiry, yet we do find here, I think, that there are some indications of human sensitivities. There are indications that he did recognize evil and wickedness. And it was here, there was wrath, there was anger against evil. It was mixed up with a great deal of other sentiment as well, I'm sure. But it was this that begins to turn the matter around. It was revealed to him, and on this occasion he was prepared to see it for what it was. And what it certainly brings to my mind is that here was a man who in many ways had a significant weakness in his character. But he was amongst the most powerful men the world has ever known. Psalm 146 says, "Do not put your trust in princes, nor in a son of man in whom there is no help." Even the most powerful, apparently, in the eyes of the world, have great weaknesses. Let's not put our trust in them. But, again, as Peter said this morning, kings are servants of God's justice, and they can be effective servants, as does turn out in this case. As he deals with this other man in the scene, Haman, and there is something that I would highlight here. You might say, well, it's not the whole story, but it is a significant part of the story, that he has been a cowardly bully. Now, to be fair, if you like, anyone of us who for any reason was standing before the king, and even if it was quite unjustified, but facing his wrath and anger, we too would be terrified. But Haman, remember, was the man who was ruling everything. He was the man who was dominant. He was the man who to whom everyone had to bow. He was the man who expected it and demanded it. Now he finds himself in a very different position. But there is someone of whom he is terrified. Very probably, knowing Haman for what he was, the indications we do have, if he had known back in chapter 3 that Esther the queen was a Jew, remember she hadn't revealed it, but if he had known, he may well have come up with a very different solution. And so we find that her silence on her origins, Mordecai advised her, remember, that they've proved now to be an important help in their eventual rescue. It brings Haman right into that place where he too is caught out by this revelation. So much so that I'm almost inclined to begin to feel a little bit sorry for him as he's set there in that impossible position. But we find him from that place of a virtually supreme power, which he used to its utmost to do as he pleased. He comes now to abject terror. There were perhaps things that he did. No doubt there were things that he had done that were for national interest or royal interest. But there were things that he had done for his own interest. But since the last chapter, he's begun to shrink. It was put into words by his wife at the end of chapter 6. He finds himself helpless in the face of multiple blows that are coming upon him. First in to his self-esteem. That was nothing beside this. He doesn't even have a hope of life. He knew that we're told back in I'm trying to see where precisely which verse it was in. I hadn't made a note of it. Yeah, in verse the end of verse 7, he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. As I said, he knew this man. He didn't know exactly what was determined against him, just that as far as the king was concerned, he was gone. He was finished. This is a point where terror gets the better of him. When the king was out, Haman stands to begin with, pleading for his life, but it comes to the point when by the time the king returns, that Haman has collapsed. He's fallen across the couch where Esther was, and it looks very bad. And the king was all the more furious. He was beyond hope. He's fallen apart. Such a transformation from his place of power, his callous abuse of that power. It was a personal slight against him. He was Haman the Formidable. Now he's just collapsed in a heap, desperately pleading for his own life. But he too, in those weaknesses, he too has a part in this tale of God overruling to deliver his people. Yes, he was the one who raised the threat against God's people first. But he was the one from whom they were to be saved. Through such a book as this, God is instructing his people. It wasn't perhaps recognized at the time and in the developments of the days. But God is instructing his people on his rule and his providing and his overruling of such men in such places. And as the book eventually closes shortly, they establish a festival of remembrance of their escape, which can only be to the recognition of God and his hand in their lives. It's set against this background of the evil men, the carelessness of men and their evil. And for us, as we take it, this as part of the unfolding of Scripture as a whole, it's a reminder that the threat of such evil is ever present. The evil one has this cowardly spirit that we spot here. He has that as well. Where he has a position of power, he will use it to the utmost. But he is himself fearful of the one who is in us. He is greater than he who is in the world. Perhaps as much on account of the rain and the sound, I'll close in just a moment. I haven't gone through all the details of the story, some that are particularly significant, but mainly the words that are spoken. You can read those events. But I want you to this evening to take a particular look at the people in the story and how they went about what they did. But in the light of this, that this is part of the story of God doing his work. The things that we do, the things that people do around us, the influential people in this world. That too is part of God's story, God doing his work. In our world, it has been since the day of Esther, right through the day of Christ, through the days of the early church, right through to the present, there have always been similar minds and hearts at play. We will do well to learn from Esther in her patience, her deliberation, her thoughtfulness. In one respect at least, I do admire the king that he gave her time to speak. We don't live in that kind of world today. It's very hard to give a deliberate answer and for people to stop and to listen. But at least let us train ourselves and develop such an approach. Certainly to be far more than Ahasuerus in his volatility. But through all of that, more than all of that, that personal example that we need to reflect on and how we should be going through our lives, more than all of that, remembering that this is God's story of his long divine act, know that even such men as Ahasuerus, as Haman, and their equivalents, that even such men can and do serve to bring about God's purposes, and they most certainly cannot divert his purposes. He will bring all things to a conclusion, to the preserving of his people in particularly through the Old Testament age, through to the place of preserving his righteous seed, and then through them, through him, rather, through his own son, the Lord Jesus, the son of David, that he might also preserve a nation, a chosen nation, a holy priesthood that we've been reading of in Peter. And evil men and the works of evil cannot divert those purposes of our God. And I will leave it there for this evening. We pray that God will settle our minds and our hearts upon his strength and put our trust in him. Let us now, we'll make our response together this evening by singing together in Psalm 79.